From London to Lisbon, from Cape Town to Charleston, we tell the stories of the people that make the world of international law and business turn. We give glimpses into their lives and provide insights from their experiences. These accounts come from every sector and every industry around the globe. Simply put, and without further ado, I am Chris Campbell, and you're listening to Tales of the Tribunal, where practice meets personality. Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal, the show where practice meets personality. I am your host, Chris Campbell, here to tell you another tale, another story from around the world of international dispute resolution and business. And today, we're going to jump right into it. Today's guest really needs no introduction, but I'm going to do my best anyway. Since 2009, Meg Kinnear has been the Secretary General of the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes, which is part of the World Bank, also known as ICSID. Meg has frequently spoken around the world and published numerous pieces on international investment law and procedure. She also lectures and teaches with a number of programs, which is how she and I met, via her professorial duties at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Meg agreed to sit down with us today to discuss what some of the buzz is about going around the ICSID, including its working paper number 4, touching on topics like third-party funding, diversity, and transparency. Additionally, she gets into how one can really get active and visible in investment arbitration, and what a day in the life of the Secretary General's office is like, especially post-COVID. I'm a big fan of Meg and her work. There are a lot of great things and tidbits passed out in this discussion, even some carpool karaoke insights. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. So sit back, relax, and pull out your favorite investment arbitration treatise or BIT and enjoy the show. We'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal with Chris Campbell, where the show where practice meets personality. I am your host, Chris Campbell, here to bring you another tale, another story from around the world of international dispute resolution. With me today, I have a very special guest, not just because of who she is, but also because she was my professor when I was in law school in Beijing at Tsinghua. So who I'm talking about is the one, the only, Miss Meg Kinnear of the ICSID. Hey, Meg, welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So that was a brief, 15-second introduction, but what we're going to do to start, as we do with all these episodes, Meg, is take a step back. Meg, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, where you're from? What do the people need to know?
All right. Well, I am a Canadian citizen. I was born in Montreal and grew up in Montreal. And did my law school actually at McGill University in Montreal. And after I had graduated from law school and from my master's, I started work with the Canadian Federal Department of Justice in the civil litigation section, which was what I had always wanted to do. And I'd wanted to go into litigation and advocacy. So that was tremendous. And went through basically and did about 12, 15 years with the Civil Litigation Department, defending Canada in civil cases. And after that, I ended up doing about 3 years as the executive assistant to the Deputy Minister of Justice. And then after that, I became the head of the Trade Law Bureau of the Department of Justice and Foreign Affairs. It was an interesting mixed department between two government departments with lawyers drawn from both Foreign Affairs and from Department of Justice. And we did a lot of, obviously, international trade cases, mainly WTO cases. We did a lot of subsidies, countervail duty, and in particular, a number of cases and negotiations about softwood lumber and disputes between Canada and the United States concerning tariffs and softwood lumber going across the border, and did what was becoming a very new area of work, but a busy area of work, which was NAFTA Chapter 11, which of course was the investment chapter of the NAFTA. So that's how I really got my introduction into trade and investment, and did that for about 10 years. And then a job came open to head ICSID as the Secretary General of ICSID. And I applied for it and was fortunate enough to succeed in that. So in 2009, I came down to Washington and I've been here ever since doing this job at ICSID.
Wow, you made that years long career kind of neatly sum up in about a 2 minute explanation. That's great, man. And so at the ICSID now, I'm sure there are a number of responsibilities and duties and things that fall on your plate and under your purview. What exactly is it that you do day to day, or how would you describe a day in the life of Meg Kinnear at the ICSID? Assuming that any 2 days are the
Yeah,
same.
exactly. And no 2 days are the same. That's one of the things that I think is the nicest about the job at ICSID, and one of the things that I was pleasantly surprised with. I thought, in fact, that being a set of rules that had been elaborated over about 50 years, that there really wouldn't be that much novel or new coming up. And in fact, I was very, very wrong on that. Every day there are new things coming up and new ways of arguing the rules that you might never have thought of, and new procedures. And so a lot of time is spent working with my lawyers on what is the right way to go in a certain case, or where a new procedure has been raised by a party, or a new problem comes up. So a lot of it is working with my lawyers to make sure that the case goes smoothly. A lot of the work is management work, essentially. We've got a group of 70 people, and it's structured almost like a law firm, essentially, with your lawyers, paralegals, and administrative help. And beside that, we have a large group that does financial and corporate type work, and then another group that does institutional work. So, for example, if a country wants to join ICSID, we explain to them what the requirements are to sign and ratify, what the benefits are. So we do a lot of that kind of work. And then there's a whole publication arm, in particular dealing with the ICSID Review, which is the law journal that we do. So all of those things are my day-to-day, plus a lot of speaking, talking to people about what ICSID is, what it does, and the advantages of ICSID. So it's a really interesting kind of job that I really, really enjoy. The last piece is one as well that I hadn't, I guess it contemplated to the extent maybe I should have, which is acting as a part of the World Bank management and dealing with some of the issues that come up more systemically at the World Bank. As you know, ICSID is one of the arms of the World Bank, but in many ways a very different one. We are the smallest, and we are not an economic arm like all of the other parts of the bank. So we participate at the general table of the World Bank, but often we have a bit of a different perspective because we're doing a different job.
Sure. I mean that sounds like a lot to manage. It's something more than a couple of a page or two of an organizational chart. And well, of course, we'll just rely on you, Meg. If you guys ever need to open up a podcast, I mean, you guys know who to call.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But that's a lot. So before we shift just a little bit, Meg, and closing off this portion, one thing that would be really interesting to know is the ICSID has a lot going on, a lot of things coming up in any given quarter or month. What are some of the things that are coming up with the ICSID that would be interesting for folks to know to keep their eye on?
Well, first of all, obviously, because of what's happened with COVID and everyone around the world going and working remotely, we have been spending a lot of time making sure that we can do our remote hearings very smoothly. We're lucky, first of all, because we've been doing remote hearings for a long time, and also because we have the World Bank technology and the World Bank security for the technology. So we're very lucky to be able to rely on that. But when we were all told we had to go and work from home, we did a number of things immediately to respond to it. And I think interestingly, the first one, of course, was that automatically all correspondence, all pleadings, everything had to be electronic. And that was something that we had been proposing in the rules just as a time-saving measure, a cost-saving measure, and it just makes sense in this day. So fortunately, we were prepared to do that. But literally, we sent out a note to everybody and posted it on our website. As of today, it's all electronic. Similarly, we had to think about how do you issue awards electronically. In the past, we had always given a copy, a hard copy of the award with the certification to the parties in case they wanted to enforce it somewhere around the world. And the question was, how do you ensure you can electronically send out a valid award? So in fact, in the other part of my home office is the ICSID seal and a little mini certification center with stamps. Yeah, exactly. So what we are doing now is we are making an original. We are scanning it to the parties. So they have basically a scanned copy of the original, but we also have the original. So if at a later date they feel they need actually the physically stamped copy, we can provide that to them. But it was not possible with COVID. But the biggest piece that we have to work on right now, obviously, is an increase in remote hearings. And probably an increase in longer remote hearings and perhaps more involved ones, ones that involve a lot of witnesses, that kind of issue. And again, our technology is really good. We were lucky to be able to jump onto that. But we had to make sure, for example, how do you do simultaneous translation when all of our translators have gone home and are not in the translation booth? So we've been able to work on that, but it was a lot of work with our staff, and they've done an amazing job. So we've done a number of these, which have been actually quite successful. And I think not only for me, but for a lot of the world, I think the lesson is this can work really well. And as you get more and more comfortable with the technology, this is something that I hope once we're all back into our normal routine, we will remember to use it more frequently than we did in the past and for a broader range of items. So not just for a first session, but for arguments, for hearings with witnesses, for all of those kind of situations. I think there's a lot of potential to save time and save money. So it's been, in a way, a bit of a silver lining to all of this, to see all of that happening.
Well, sure. And I think, you know, tagging on to that last point, it's also just a great way to treat the environment, especially when we consider things like the Green Pledge that have come forward and other ideas to not have to use so much carbon, have such a huge carbon footprint in traveling for these hearings and those sorts of impacts on the environment.
Yeah, it's huge when you think of how many people come to a hearing, not just the arbitrators, but the counsel, the clients, the witnesses. It's a huge impact. So that's right. That's one of the other advantages.
And well, and actually, you know, so what I was going to tee up before, but you just answered so well, Meg, was that, you know, our stats here look like something like 60% of the 200 hearings and sessions organized by ICSID were held via video conference. I'm sure we'll see that number probably skyrocket for 2020, and it might stay somewhere thereabouts going forward.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I was contemplating when is it that we will be back doing regular in-person hearings, and I think for many reasons it's going to be a bit longer than anybody contemplated. And one of the things, and we've done it to a lesser degree in the past, but something that you might think of almost as hybrid hearings, so that you have a group, for example, in Paris and a group in Washington, and maybe the three arbitrators in Washington physically in the hearing, but others participating remotely. And I suspect we will not go straight back to 100% everybody going into the room with their boxes and et cetera. I suspect we're going to be doing these hybrid hearings for a while, which I think is a really good idea. So we've been thinking about how do you transition back into the hearing process. And I think there are probably going to be some new ways of doing things.
Well, I think that that's true. And I think that maybe whether we were ready or not, we have kind of all been thrust into the future, you know, the world of tomorrow, as it were.
That's exactly it. I mean, it really has leapfrogged us into where we thought we knew we had to go. But we're there now, as opposed to another year or two from now.
Well, sure. And I think it's hard to make the argument as things return to whatever normal is to say that, well, now we should go back to doing things this way that take more, cost more money, have a more of an impact on the environment, take longer. You know, I think that that's a hard sell for people.
That's exactly it. And the thing we have found with the remote hearings, the 99.9% of the success is that you spend some time in advance getting comfortable with the technology. And in fact, one of the things our council have been doing is spending as much time as needed, and sometimes that's 2, 3 days, but in advance of the actual hearing, doing test runs with the arbitrators and with the council and getting them comfortable with the technology. And once you've got that, and of course using it can only make that better, but once you've got that comfort with the technology level, I think it's going to be much more natural to say, why do we need to all come to the same place? Let's try it electronically.
Sure, and I think so that those are things that we know will certainly change going forward. One thing that we hope will change as well, that was addressed in ICSID's 2019 annual report, was the issue of diversity in a gender sense amongst the arbitrators that were appointed. Again, looking at our kind of stats that we've compiled, something like 106 male appointees occurred, and 31 female arbitrator appointments were made. Across 2019, during as reported in the 2019 report. Well, the question that comes, I guess, in light of that is, what steps is ICSID planning to take to increase female representation in arbitrators and appointments in ICSID disputes? And does that same sort of thought process also extend to ethnic and culture diversity as well?
That's exactly it. I think really the tools are almost the same to increase gender diversity as regional diversity. And that's something, both of these have been something that we've been very focused on for quite a while. And as you know, we actually report all of these things in our annual report. Not only is that for information, but also that keeps us accountable quite clearly and quite publicly. We've done a number of things to try and increase diversity, and we have seen the numbers go up. Obviously, it's not parity at this point in terms of gender, but it is a huge increase and a lot of improvement from even, let's say, 5 years ago. So one of the things is where ICSID gets to a point, we try and put several females on the list or the ballot for the parties to consider, so that these people are at least being considered for those appointments by the parties. We consider it as well when we are appointing from our panel of arbitrators. And that's a panel, as you know, that's created by states where they each put four arbitrators and four conciliators. So one of the things that's been key is getting our states to also have an awareness of how important it is not just to have quality candidates, but candidates that represent different regions and female and male. So we have very much tried to alert our states to this, and I think you'll see in the more recent appointments, this has actually been a factor that states are conscious of now and that they are taking into account when they appoint to the list. We have also been trying to encourage people from different regions as well as females to participate in other things. I think other things done by the center, for example, programs, writing in the ICSID review, and all of that goes back to the idea of it's very important to have a visibility. I know that most counsel, when they sit down to think who are the arbitrators that I might appoint for this case, they think of a broad range of people. And so the idea is to expand the number of people they might think of, and that will over time result in more female arbitrators or arbitrators from different regions. So really just getting these people on the public scene, getting them known by council who are doing most of the appointments realistically, and developing a level of trust in them. This person actually does know their stuff, and so they would be a good potential choice. So there's a lot of that. And I think the other thing we're seeing, of course, is that there's just more people in the pipeline getting to the stage where they're ready to be arbitrators. And so those efforts combined with, I guess, just sort of generational or demographics mean I think you are going to see increasing diversification. But it's something you always have to keep encouraging people to keep top of mind. So when you sit down, take an extra 10 minutes. Is this a diverse list? Who else might be a possibility that you might not thought of automatically?
Well, sure, and that those sound all like things that would make sense to increase diversity in those senses. I then would wonder a little bit that I wonder if there's almost some sort of a compounding effect. So that is to say, you know, certainly whenever it is that the current generation of arbitrators sort of step aside, whoever that they've worked with, whoever their colleagues are, whoever they've advised and sort of, hey, this is how you become an ICSID arbitrator, kind of already have somewhat of a cleared path, whereas those that are coming up and those from these underrepresented groups would, okay, yes, the path is clearing, but they still just comparatively, there's so much of an advantage that I wonder how that is balanced or leveled off at some point. Do you have any thoughts there?
Well, one of the things that I think is kind of nice is that not just counsel are becoming aware of this, but so are arbitrators. And we often have arbitrators say, you know, I sat with so-and-so last week. It was the first time, and they're a new and up-and-coming person, and you should keep your eye on them because they're going to be tremendous. Or just giving us suggestions and feedback, which is fantastic. So in many ways, the older generation is helping to give visibility to the new generation. I think they're very much a part of that. And they're also very good, I find, about mentoring them, about helping them. So where you might have two arbitrators who've done quite a number of cases and one who's on one of their first or early cases, they are really good about talking to them about things that you can do, getting them really participating. So I think there's sort of an informal mentorship happening there, which is really very helpful.
No, that's great. And I hope that continues to be the trend. One trend that we have seen, and I know that just, you know, I don't think that there's any sort of set standard one way or another, is the sort of practice of arbitrators still making their livelihood as counsel. So we sort of find ourselves in the situation where, you know, arbitrator one week, counsel the next week. You know, I certainly don't ask you to take a stance on that debate, but I would be curious to hear what are some of the trends or things that you've seen just so far in your work, and is there any way that you see that the wind is blowing on that particular issue?
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. This is the whole thing. It's called double hatting. And I, in a way, I hate that word because it's not a technical term of art, but it's really what everybody knows this as. So it's something that we've obviously given a lot of thought to. And we've just released a draft code of conduct that we put together with the UNSA Trials Secretariat. And one of the articles in that draft, the Article 6, I think we've called it multiple roles as opposed to double hatting. But it makes you think about these kinds of issues. And I think one of the problems, like all great problems, it is not easy and it is not clear. On the one side, I think, is the obvious thing. Nobody wants conflict. Conflict of interest is not a good thing. So that obviously is the one goal. On the other hand, there are a lot of perhaps unintended consequences if you simply have a ban. You may not simultaneously be counsel and arbitrator. If you have that kind of ban, first of all, I think it can be over-inclusive. It is not necessarily a conflict. You have to look much more carefully at the facts and the parties and those kind of things. But the more unintended consequences is, in fact, to the newcomers we've just talked about. Most people cannot afford to get their first investor state case and give up their entire practice and hope that a lot more investor state cases come along.
Right, that would be nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Work like that.
I think a lot of, there are some statistics as well, that there are a lot of people, and I remember being surprised at the extent to which a number of people only did in their lifetime one or two or three investor state cases. If you had this strict ban or separation between the counsel role and the arbitrator role, there are a lot of people who just financially would not be able to start on their course as an arbitrator. So it really would have an exclusive effect as opposed to diversifying the profession. And that is a problem. So these are all the things that I think are going to have to be considered when the delegates get together, and having people understand unintended consequences and not just this is about conflict or not. And really, in many ways, it comes down to Do you need those kind of descriptive bands? You can't be counsel and arbitrator, or expert witness and arbitrator, or do the basic rules on conflict give you the tools you need to figure out who has a disqualifying conflict and who does not? And that's the question that delegates are going to have to wrestle with.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as with many issues, especially in law, is there are certain talking points that sound nice and are snappy, but it definitely requires some nuance.
That's exactly it. And this one is one of those ones where you need to dig further and really weigh the pros and cons. And it's not just about we all don't believe in conflict, because it's true. Nobody wants an arbitrator who's conflicted, but it is a more complex problem.
But we could just conflict them all out, and then that way that just makes the room for all the up-and-coming arbitrators.
Absolutely, and then they can conflict one another.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm joking. So Meg, what I, you know, shifting from that point, leaving that where it lies, about several months ago in February 2020, the ICSID published its latest working paper with some proposed changes to modernize its rules, working paper number 4, so to speak. A new provision that deems that a party has given consent to publish its awards unless it objects to the writing within 60 days, which is alleged to be leading to enhanced transparency, what was discussed. In this regard, what are your reviews on transparency in investor-state arbitration, and are you anticipating there to be a greater use of the UNCENTRAL rules on transparency in the future?
Yeah. Well, as you say, the transparency provisions in ICSID's proposals right now really are aimed at increasing transparency. And we have a history of having increased transparency and supporting transparency. So in the last set of amendments, 2006, that's where you really got the first institutional rules on making documents public, having open hearings, and non-disputing party participation. So we led in that sense, and we wanted to increase transparency when we put these proposals forward. At the same time, you have to really understand that not all states, and indeed not all stakeholders, are in favor of 100% transparency or the kind of level of transparency you see in the Mauritius Convention UNCITRAL rules. And a number of states have started to address it on a very specific basis in their new treaties. And because we need consensus on these rules, we had to say, what is an increased level of transparency, but one where there can be consensus among the parties? And then parties can certainly increase or exceed that level in their individual treaties. But the idea is to move forward a step, but still get consensus on these rules. So in terms of award, there was a bit of a tricky issue, which is the ICSID Convention says awards require consent of the parties. And we know, in fact, that a lot of the time when parties are finished a case, they rush off and do other things. And we're sending letters saying, do we have your consent? And we just can't get any answers back from the parties. So that
right.
was the genesis of the deemed consent. It's meant to be a very easy thing. All you need to do is within 60 days say, yes, I consent, or the parties consent to a redacted version, or no, I don't consent. So it's meant to be very simple to comply with. But if no party gets back to us within the 60 days, it basically is an encouragement to transparency and to publishing the award. We've also increased publication of decisions and orders. And obviously the logic behind that, when you go back to the systemic concerns that we hear a lot, problems like there is not enough consistency. Well, if you want to have consistency, you've got to know what other tribunals are deciding. So we thought that was really important to put our efforts into having more case law made public. And so that is part of the provisions that support making case law public.
Sure. No, I think that that's all well said. Several years ago, I was on at a conference in Atlanta with your co-professor from Tsinghua, Professor Bjorklund, and we talked about some of these investor state issues and transparency there. And then I wrote a paper on Transparency International Arbitration, citing some of the work of Professor Rogers from Penn State. And it seems like maybe the issue isn't so much at, you know, saying this has to be the rule for transparency across the board, as it is considering what state interests are involved and what level of transparency is due there. You know, in the world of commercial arbitration, where most folks sort of deal, there's shrouds of confidentiality everywhere. But to the extent that you're actually talking about appropriating public funds or public resources, perhaps that's more a useful principle than it is to say across the board, you always have to do this type of transparency.
That's exactly. And because almost always, well, by definition, one party is always a state entity, you get into a number of discussions that are perhaps more more complex than in commercial arbitration. You get into things like, is there an executive privilege and how does that affect governance? In the Canadian context, in NAFTA, there were a number of cases about whether there was a cabinet confidence, which essentially was the cabinet under the parliamentary system has to be able to discuss fully and fairly, and that you will impinge on that ability if all of those deliberations are then out in the public. So it's very much in Canadian domestic law. It is, in fact, in the Canada Evidence Act, and there are severe penalties for disclosing a cabinet confidence. And yet, in the international law sense, it didn't appear that there was anything that might shield that. And so there were a whole set of cases in the beginning of the NAFTA where that was one of the discussions. I think those kinds of issues don't tend to come up in commercial law. So there are, as you say, on the one side, some sensitive government interests. On the other side, there are also government interests in being accountable to their population, saying, look, this is what we're doing. We are being challenged because of this measure we took, and we are defending on this basis. And the public, if they are interested, should be able to access that kind of information. So it is a whole different problem.
Sure. And you just mentioned NAFTA just a few moments ago. As it goes, I guess, on the transparency point specifically, have there been any appreciable differences in the USMCA in terms of its approach towards transparency, or is it still pretty staying in line with NAFTA?
I guess the difference is not necessarily transparency, but investor state at
all. Sure, exactly. Well, I wasn't going to hit on that too hard, but yes.
Yeah, exactly. So really the question is, as you know, the USMCA has this three-year period, legacy period, I think is what the treaty calls it, for cases that arise under the consent formerly given with respect to Canada and the U.S. But as between Canada and the U.S., there is no investor state under the USMCA. So that's the large thing. And then as between Mexico and the United States, there's a limited range of specific types of cases where there can be investor state. On the other hand, as between Canada and Mexico, I suspect you'll see that now under the CPTPP, where both Canada and Mexico are partners. So, you know, this is one of the new issues that we're starting to see as you get multiple treaties, including, you know, bilateral, regional, multilateral, plurilateral. Sometimes you get these combinations where two states are in fact subject to two or three different investor state set of obligations as between them by virtue of these other treaties. I assume we will see pleadings in the alternate, or parties will pick the treaty that they think is the best for the circumstances. But this is one of those new issues that we haven't seen come up in case law yet, but I think it's probably inevitable that at some point we're going to have this issue about what treaty applies.
Yeah, just give it time. We'll put a stake in it and see. Yeah, all right. Today's May 18th. Let's see when it actually arrives. But well said, well said. Revisiting WP number 4 for just a moment. Mm. The proposed rules introduce an obligation by the parties to disclose the name and address of the non-parties to which they received funding, directly or indirectly. which, as listeners to the show will know, my favorite topic, third-party funding. How will such an explicit obligation to disclose third-party funding change the landscape of investment arbitration, in particular with respect to ICSID disputes?
Yeah. It's interesting. When we started this amendment process, we did what we called a scoping exercise. Basically, what are the issues you think ought to be considered in this process? And not that they would necessarily all end up in a final proposed amendment, but what are the issues that we should deal with? And there were a huge number of issues, and we had suggestions not only from states, but also stakeholders. And third-party funding was one of the big items that everybody wanted us to address. The difficulty, of course, is that there were views all across the spectrum about how you address third-party funding. So everything from those parties who said third-party funding is bad, third-party funding creates frivolous cases, all the way to those who saw it totally different. Third-party funding is the only way that small and medium-sized investors can participate in the process and can actually vindicate where there's been a breach of their rights. So you see the whole spectrum, and it is very difficult from that perspective. And the question is really, how do you regulate it in terms of rules? And I think from the beginning, what we said is we are not able to, and we're not going to try at this point, to make a policy decision, is third-party funding good or bad? We're going to start from the premise that third-party funding is a recognized legal tool. But right. Is there a possibility of harm to the system? And the one I think that is concrete is the potential if there is some kind of a conflict between your arbitrators and the third-party funder. So the focus of this rule really is to catch those unintended consequences, and you do so by making your declaration about whether you have third-party funding, and all you're required to disclose is the name and address of the funder, and then that is tailed with an expanded declaration on the part of the arbitrator, who has to say whether they are working with that funder. So you've got that, and as you say, the declaration is kept up to date all the way through the process. So we were starting to see cases where arbitrators were asked to order disclosure, and we were starting to see different kinds of results or different approaches, all using sort of inherent power. What I think this does is basically capture what the trend was becoming anyhow, but gives you a process and a uniform set of expectations about what has to be disclosed and how you do it and when you do it. So that's how we've approached third-party funding. And I think it's probably quite consistent with what we've seen in treaties that try to address third-party funding. Going beyond that is something, as I say, that we have not done. And I don't think any of the treaties have really gone beyond that conflict issue, even though there's lots of discussions about overall, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? But even defining it is extraordinarily difficult, quite frankly. So we've stuck to something that's very clear that can be implemented in practice and will address that conflict situation.
Got it. Here's an easier question. Maybe.
Good.
If you could take out your crystal ball and I say it's easier because, you know, we won't know for 5 to 10 years. What are you expecting to see over the next 5 to 10 years for ICSID and the convention, in the ICSID convention? Do you have any guesses, any thoughts about where things might be going?
I have a few guesses, and you're right. This is very much crystal balling, so let's preface it with don't hold me to it at the end of the day. A number of things. We have seen a steady increase in the number of states that are joining the ICSID convention mechanism. I think we're going to keep seeing that. I think we'll certainly have the updated set of rules adopted and implemented and start seeing how that impacts the discipline. As we discussed earlier, I think we're certainly going to see an increase in the amount and the sophistication of remote technology for hearings. And one of the things I'm really excited about, and this comes out of the amendment process, but we've got a standalone set of mediation rules, and we've made them very broadly available. They're not required to be triggered by being a member of ICSID. They are broadly available by consent in investor state cases. And there's a lot of enthusiasm about these. It was, again, one of the big issues when we did our scoping. And I want to see, and I hope to see, really effective use of mediation, not necessarily as a substitute for arbitration, but perhaps as sort of a complement to it. And this is something where I think if we can get some success stories, it's going to be really good for both investors and states. So I'm hoping that's also part of the future that we see. And I think there's every reason to think that that is going to be part of the future.
Sure. No, I think that those are good guesses. We can mark those down if you're good about those.
Good enough.
I recognize that at some point one of my guests is going to turn that question back on me and say, how about you? What do you see about podcasts? What do you think about, you know, whatever the topic is? And I was like, okay, next question. okay, but shifting focus just a bit, Meg. One thing that I love to ask my guests, because you get so many different types of answers, is as you have had such a storied career, you've done many things at a number of different places. Now, looking back at what you've done so far, who has been or what have been some of your mentors, some of your guiding forces, some of the things that have kind of shaped your professional philosophy or how you kind of see your practice and your work?
I've been lucky to have a lot of mentors in my career. And every one of them, I think, has sort of given me a different bit of education and a different perspective onto things that end up being very useful with it, whatever you do next. I think in particular, I had a number of wonderful litigator mentors during my early career. And when I went to be the executive assistant to the deputy minister, I worked for two fabulous deputy ministers who were really, really bright in terms of policy and managing issues within a bureaucracy and managing issues with a public. And I learned a huge amount there. Again, I had never expected that. But not only did I learn a lot there, when I ultimately got to do the job at the Trade Law Bureau and then at ICSID, all of a sudden those skills became really important because you are accountable to your stakeholders, you're accountable to states. You have a number of media outlets who are interested in investor state. So all of those tools became very, very important and very useful as I went from one job to the other, when probably at the beginning I might have said, no idea why I would ever need to know that. So it all becomes part of a package that I think you end up taking with you from job to job and adding new things to it. So I've been lucky to have some really tremendous mentors.
No, that's great, and I think that that's sort of a tricky question, right? I think that there's so many things that are part of our journeys to figuring out where we are and how we view our things that it's hard to say that one specific thing. So I think that that's well contemplated. This is definitely an easier question. What are you reading now? What was the last thing you read?
Oh, the last thing I read was a book called Catch and Release by Ronan Farrow. Which was a fascinating book and really, really good. But right now I'm on to a bit of a watching documentary films. That's my that's my relaxation right now. So there's a fabulous documentary film festival every year in Toronto called Hot Docs, and you can get a pass for it. So I and a good friend of mine have been doing what we call our doc-a-day. We're trying to do a doc-a-day. So that's been my outside entertainment lately.
No, that's fair enough. I am actually in the midst of reading a book from a Harvard professor called Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire by Rebecca Henderson. It's just come out here the past several weeks, and I think a world on fire. I don't know. Maybe that's a touch too much, but you know, definitely in a world that's trying to answer a lot of questions. So,
yeah.
Good reading. And keeping on the theme or the topic of external sort of entertainment things to keep you busy, what sort of music are you into? What kind of things do you like to listen to in your spare time?
I don't know if this is a genre, but the kind of music I like to listen to is music that you can sing at the top of your lungs as you do a road trip, basically. So I don't know, it's something called road trip music.
Show tunes, all that kind of stuff.
Mine tends to go sort of 70s, 80s, 90s. Occasionally, we sneak more recent things into it. But as long as you can sing when nobody's listening, it's just fine as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, you can belt out a few tunes right now. I mean, if you
Yeah.
want to drop some bars.
Yeah, no, I could, but I just think I don't know what it would do to your listenership, Chris. I'm not going to do that to you.
Sure. No, that's fair. That's fair enough. Any specific artist, anyone in particular that sticks out of that category?
It sounds ridiculous, but I like all of the Motown songs, a number of Canadian artists who are fantastic, Don Henley. I'm trying to think. I just this weekend had to drive to New York with my daughter to empty her apartment. So we had a rule that the driver could choose the music. So I imposed all of that music on her, and she was very gracious, but wanted to drive more than she would let me drive.
Now, see, I heard a rumor that you may be a Joni Mitchell fan. Is that
Absolutely. No good Canadian cannot be a Joni Mitchell
right? No, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. That's really cool. Shifting from those types of things just a bit. And I think this is something that just is true whether you're the Secretary General of ICSID or you are just starting your career. We all find ourselves to be extremely busy. Many demands from work life, from personal life, everywhere in between. But it's still immensely important to sort of maintain and take care of your physical and your mental health. How do you find, or what are some of the things that you do, or routines that you have in order to sort of maintain the balance in those two arenas?
Yeah. I do a lot of walking, and in fact, I often walk to work and back, which is a good 50 minutes each way. So I
Wow.
do that, and that's not just to try and maintain some physical balance, but also mental balance. It's that quiet time you get to figure things out in your mind, and the things that are going around and around, you kind of get to nail them down. And by the time I get to the office, I think I have a direction I want to go in. So I do that, and I've started yoga in the last 5 years and become a big fan of yoga.
All
So those
right.
are my two main pastimes outside of work.
I've been dabbling in some yoga, I guess myself during the lockdown. Got to keep it limber, but I have a long way to go on this journey.
It's a fantastic thing that. You know, what's great about it is anybody can do it, and you can do it a very low level of proficiency up to a very high level of proficiency. So I'm on the lower level, but it always helps in terms of you feel after a yoga session, you're standing about 3 inches taller, and it's wonderful. So I'm a real fan of that.
No, I get that. So I get the similar feeling after after lifting weights. I feel like, okay, I am now invigorated. The blood is pumping. But
I'm powerful.
I don't know when we'll be able to return to the gym. So yoga and running have been my outlets during this time.
Exactly. Exactly.
As I'm sure happens in the before times, as we called them before the lockdown, when we would go to conferences, and maybe you get these into your email or LinkedIn from time to time. You might get approached by a recent graduate or someone looking to make a kind of a hard pivot into doing investor state work. What advice would you have for someone that wants to pursue that sort of path? I guess both from two different angles. One, from someone that's already practicing and looking to make a shift, or two, someone that's just graduating and says, okay, I'm ready to go be an arbitrator, an investor state arbitrator.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I always say is don't limit your focus too much. As exciting as investor state is, you have to remember it's probably about 5% of the overall arbitration pool. So if you say, all I'm going to do is investor state, you're going to find that it's hard to find those pieces that fit into that objective. But more than that, I think it's really important to get the skills you need to be a good advocate. So I always say things that maybe sound very basic but are critical. Number one is become a really good writer. Edit, edit, edit. Number two is get your advocacy skills. So, for example, I remember when I was first doing civil litigation in Canada, I actually went and did criminal litigation for about 2 days a week. Went down to the court and did basic things like, you know, it was even an offense of having too many fishing lines in the water and that kind of stuff, like starting at the basics. The idea is it's all advocacy and you get good on your feet and good at speaking and good at those kind of skills. So get that kind of exposure anywhere you can. I also say it's important to be visible, and visible is through speaking, through volunteering, through writing, and it does not always have to be the magnum opus PhD thesis. A really good, strong 10-page case comment is almost just as useful. Just get that exposure so people start to know who you are and that you have knowledge about this field. I think that's really important, and you have to develop that. And as I say, be willing to do various different things. Don't get too stuck on a path that doesn't let you go left or right when something comes up.
Sure. No, I think that's great. And I think that last point that you made is in particular strong, particularly strong as it goes to being visible. I think that too often folks think that when they want to speak in a forum where there's senior practitioners or even just their contemporaries, that they either have to, you know, be talking about the thing that's going to change the entire industry, or they have to write, you know, the next treatise on a particular topic. And I think there's a lot of value to just saying, you know, there's so much information out there. If you just take something, you analyze it, even a five pager, and you say, here are the main takeaways. That is something that someone can put in their pocket, and, you know, they'll save that, you know. But I chuckle sometimes when I hear folks say, oh, well, I don't have anything to say. You definitely have something to say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And doing that kind of synthesis and organization is hugely important. And to me, that goes back to a skill you're going to use in advocacy. I've got 80 banker's boxes worth of information. Do I really think the arbitrator is going to remember every single bit of it? No, it's synthesizing it, putting it under the main headings of your argument and making it powerful in that sense. So it's all the same skills in different contexts.
And this wasn't intended to be this way, but for you Moody's or future Moody's that are listening to this episode, when you go to Vienna or you're participating, whatever moot you're doing, it's exactly the same. Look, everyone has done the research. Everyone has looked through the case file. What's going to be most persuasive is if you've distilled that argument down, you made some good examples, a good metaphor, and you really hit it, the themes of your case. You know, don't need to tell the arbitrator, oh, here are all the possible arguments as to why you could find for me.
Yeah, exactly. No, selectivity is key. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Meg, we're winding down here. But one question I can't, you know, that I'd love to end on, and I always find it interesting to see what people are going to say. Let's say it's 5 p.m. on a Friday. Somehow you know, there's nothing work-related at all for you to do. You can wave a magic wand. There's no COVID, and do whatever you'd like. How would you spend your weekend?
I jump in the car, and I drive down to the beach, which allows me to sing badly for about 3 hours. And to basically spend the weekend walking up and down the beach. For a long time, the beach and the ocean has been my happy place. So that's a very easy question.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Here's a guilty secret. Maybe not a surprise to listeners to know that it's Hamilton related, but for long flights or for trips like that, I know that exactly the Hamilton is just over 2.5 hours. So it is an easy excuse for me to say, I think I'm just going to listen to the entirety of Hamilton. So that sounds like a great weekend. That sounds like a fun time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's all.
I would agree. Well, Meg, I appreciate you stopping by our virtual studio today. Really appreciate you being here. Do you have any shout outs that you want to give to the folks at home?
I do. First of all, to my colleagues at ICSID, who have always been amazing, but have been extra amazing during this last period. A shout out to all my friends in Canada who have been staying in touch. That's been a fantastic, heartwarming thing. And I think, like all of us, absolute thanks and admiration for all of those people who are keeping the world going. Everyone from doctors and nurses to the mailmen and the FedEx delivery people, absolute gratitude and admiration for what they're doing. So those are the ones that I'd like to shout out to today.
No, that's great. I think that's a good shout out. Well, again, thanks for coming by, Meg. Really appreciate you stopping by the studio. Do you want to sign us off?
I do. I'm Meg Kinnear, and there's no disputing it. You're listening to Tales of the Tribunal.
Thanks, Meg, and we'll see y'all next time.
Thanks, Chris.
So, that was my conversation with Meg Kinnear. It's always a pleasure catching up with her, especially when we get a chance to chat that's longer than just a brief catch-up in between sessions at a conference or between panels. Which, I guess, at the time you're hearing this, still won't be happening for most of us, and definitely not in 2020. In any case, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. A couple of closing points before we get out of here. Arbitration in the Afternoon, the webinar series that I host with Mandy Lee over at Careers in Arbitration, has its next event in the works. You'll have to wait till next week to hear about it, but I guarantee you it's going to be something special and you won't want to miss it. Anyway, that's relatively short. Not that many notes for today. Let's get into the credits. Research for today's episode was conducted by Romy Coley. Intro and outro music was conducted by Joshua and Jaden Campbell. Thanks for listening. And there's no disputing it. You're listening to Tales of the Tribunal. And we'll see you next time.